It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
The buck starts here.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in Los Angeles. I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the Morning Open, a look at the economy as we're just minutes into the trading day. Earnings out, but the dollar gets in the way. Plenty of the newly jobless seeking dollars from Uncle Sam. First, where's Wall Street? S&P 500 up about 0.25%, 0.33% for the NASDAQ, and the Dow's up as well about 0.33% at 89.07. European markets mostly flat right now. Asian shares closed higher today as well. Jane DeRista is with the Political Economy Research Institute at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She joins us live this morning on the phone. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning.
Lots of earnings out today. We could be here till Labor Day talking about them, but we have McDonald's and Philip Morris saying profits are down thanks to a stronger dollar. I thought a stronger dollar is good for the economy, Jane.
No, it is not. It never has been. It's good for the financial sector, and that certainly translates into good things for Goldman Sachs. But if companies have lots of overseas operations, their earnings are going to be down because they're getting paid in weaker currencies over there and translating into the stronger dollar. Also, their exports are going to be down because you can't sell abroad and you can't sell at home if there's a strong dollar.
We also heard from AT&T this morning as well. Their profits slid 15% thanks to all the hoopla over the iPhone. But the iPhone is one of the most popular phones around. I mean, why isn't AT&T in better shape?
There's an awful lot of competition coming out there from the internet, from the cable companies, from Skype, et cetera. And, of course, also the point is that AT&T was selling those phones with a lot of discount.
All right, Jane, hang on the line just for a moment. We got word this morning that the initial unemployment claims rose a bit last week, more than 500,000 people filing claims for the first time. We're going to check in live with our New York Bureau and Marketplace's Amy Scott, who's got the latest on that. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So what do these numbers tell us?
Well, we've got sort of a mix of good and bad news in these figures. Overall, first-time jobless claims have been falling since the spring, and the number of people continuing to receive unemployment insurance fell last week. But I'm told that's partly because more people are exhausting their benefits. So the jobs picture is still pretty bleak.
So we've been hearing a lot lately about this idea of a jobless recovery, Amy. Looks like these numbers bolster that notion.
Well, in the last few recessions in this country, jobs have taken a long time to recover to their previous levels. Some say it could be 5 or 6 years this time around. Employers are reluctant to start hiring until they see a sustained recovery. I talked to economist Hugh Johnson with Johnson Illington Advisors, and he says unemployment is likely to stay high even as other parts of the economy improve, and that could actually threaten the recovery.
You can have a recovery without much job growth, but you don't get a solid recovery unless you get solid job growth and consumer spending. Ordinarily, you have to have both.
So people might fairly ask, what good is a recovery if you don't have jobs? And Johnson says it's just going to take a little bit more patience this time around.
All right. Marketplace's Amy Scott joining us from New York. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
We do appreciate it. All right, Jane DeRista, is that on target, a recovery perhaps, but one without jobs?
Well, I think that the point is being well made that unless you have the wage income, things are not going to turn around in this economy. People have to pay down debt. We're still going to have a housing problem, which we have not solved. We have a commercial real estate problem because people are not going to malls and buying things. So all of these little bits and pieces add up over the place. And it's also a problem in terms of the loss of jobs for spending. What is happening to people's savings, what is happening to their 401ks, et cetera.
All right. Jane DeRista joining us from Massachusetts this morning. Jane, thank you.
Thank you.
All listening to The Morning Report for Thursday, July 23rd, 2009 at Marketplace.org. We got word from Europe this morning that Credit Suisse reported higher profits, up 29%. But some are hoping to rein in banks and protect consumers there. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
A British advocacy group wants to stop the banks charging what they call excessive interest rates. So they want to restore the old usury laws. The group includes labour unionists, community workers and members from all the main faiths. It's called London Citizens. They argue that banks should not be allowed to charge more than 10% for loans. At the moment, they claim, the British banks are profiteering. They borrow from the Bank of England at a half of 1% and then lend to their customers at up to 25%. Maurice Glassman of London Citizens says this kind of greedy behaviour caused the credit crunch.
The root of the problems for the banks was that they charged loans at very high rates of interest, and there was huge defaulting, which we now call toxic loan, of the subprime mortgage crisis.
His group has joined forces with a similar American body, the Industrial Areas Foundation. They plan to lobby the governments on both sides of the pond to curb what they call extortionate lending. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
A new study out today makes an economic case for rebuilding dwindling fish populations as quickly as possible. The report from the Pew Environment Group aims to answer ongoing complaints about federal catch limits on overfished species. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Right now, nearly a quarter of U.S. fish stocks are badly depleted. Federal law now requires that most overfished species be rebuilt within 10 years. That means imposing strict annual quotas on how much fishermen can catch. Commercial fishermen and charter boat operators complain the quotas are killing their business. But the Pew study suggests the short-term economic pain is worth it. Lee Crockett is director of federal fisheries policy at Pew.
The longer you drag this out, the harder it is for the stock to rebound, because if you continue to allow overfishing at a too high rate, the population is going to continue to decline and you're going to have to make larger cuts.
The study argues that if just four mid-Atlantic species had been rebuilt by 2007, the commercial and recreational fishing industries would be making over $500 million more each year than they are now. But fishing groups in New York and New Jersey are pushing legislation in Congress that would loosen federal rules on overfishing. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The Cash for Clunkers program begins tomorrow. Check out a registered car dealer, trade in your old gas guzzler for a newer, fuel-efficient car, and the government contributes as much as $4,500 toward the cost of a new vehicle. But it's not quite as simple as it sounds. Rico Galliano has the details.
If you watch television, like, at all, you'll likely see lots of Cash for Clunkers ads like this one from Phil Fitzford in Pennsylvania.
Bring in that old jalopy and get up to $4,500 towards the purchase of a newer select used vehicle.
The ad features shots of junkers from the 50s and 60s. The problem? Cash for Clunkers doesn't apply to jalopies that old. Edmunds.com advice editor Phil Reed says that's just one misconception consumers may have.
You have to have a car that's newer than 1984, and it also has to get 18 miles per gallon or less combined EPA rating.
And if you think you can buy a clunker today and cash it in tomorrow, think again. To get the money, you need to have owned the car a year. One more thing. Even if you qualify for the program, the car shopping maxim still applies. Buyer beware.
If you march into a dealership and you say, I've got a clunker, want to buy a new car, the dealer knows that you're $4,500 ahead of the game, and they're going to hold the line on the new car.
So Reed says negotiate the price of the newer car first, then tell them you've got a clunker to trade. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
President Obama continues his aim to get health care reform sooner rather than later. Today, he holds a town hall meeting in Ohio at the Cleveland Clinic, a place he, just last night, called a role model for the type of health care change Americans want.
They've set up a system where patient care is the number one concern, not bureaucracy, what forms have to be filled out, what do we get reimbursed for. Those are changes that I think the American people want to see.
The president at his White House news conference last night. This morning, reporter Tamara Keith gives us a lowdown on why the president's so impressed with the place.
President Obama has said repeatedly the goal of overhauling health care is to cover the uninsured and to improve quality while cutting costs. At a time when health care legislation is getting hit from all sides, the president is highlighting a hospital system that's widely viewed as a success story.
The total cost is lower, outcomes are better, patient satisfaction is higher, and doctor satisfaction is higher.
Maggie Mahar is a healthcare fellow at the Century Foundation, a left-leaning think tank. She says unlike most physicians, Cleveland Clinic doctors are paid a salary with no extra financial incentives for production. Mahar says that means their only aim is quality care, not billable procedures.
This means that there's no financial incentive for them to run another test, to try another treatment.
Because healthcare is one of the few areas where more isn't necessarily better. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
A Porsche may be able to outrace a Volkswagen any day, but the Porsche company has lost its race to stay independent of VW. Earlier this morning, Porsche announced that its CEO and CFO have both resigned. From Berlin, Brett Neely has more.
Porsche's boss, Wendelin Wiedeking, was credited with saving the company when he joined 16 years ago. Then he set his sights on taking over Volkswagen, many times Porsche's size. He came close, but failed in the end. That left the company with billions in debt just as the recession hit and made it a takeover target for Volkswagen. Auto expert Stefan Bratzel says there's only one way to interpret Wiedeking's resignation.
Now it seems clear that Porsche and Volkswagen will be within a common company.
But Wiedeking, who is Germany's best-paid CEO, won't leave the company empty-handed. He's getting a $70 million golden handshake. To keep critics quiet, Wiedeking announced that half the money will go to charity. One cause he's supporting? A fund to help out aging journalists in need. In Berlin, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Well, we got those first-time unemployment claim numbers this morning, and while new claims have been coming down overall week by week, the unemployment rate continues to be high. So what does that mean for the economy? We're joined by economics correspondent Chris Farrell to talk about how employment figures into any upturn that may be on its way. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Doing well. So when the people who determine these things write the book or stamp this recession as done, what will be the consensus, do you think, concerning job creation after this period?
What job creation is going to be another jobless recovery? I mean, think about this, Steve. The last downturn, when we had the tech bubble burst, it took about 4 years for the labor market to rebound. Now, we're going through the Great Recession, the longest and most severe downturn since the Great Depression. And that's why we're going to see a slow uptick in the job market.
So, I mean, what kind of jobs are we talking about? Where will these jobs come from if they are created down the road?
Healthcare and education. And also skilled workers are going to continue to get jobs. And I see a rebound in manufacturing. Manufacturing has just been devastated. It has been devastated. They've cut way below the bone. They cut into that bone. And so I don't think it's going to take much of a pickup in demand for all of a sudden employers to go, we got to fill these orders. Because employers, I don't know about the employers you know, Steve, but you know, most employers I know, they don't want to pass on orders. And they're going to work their existing workforce harder, but I think they've cut so deep, they're going to have to add some workers.
Does the fact, Chris, that we're a nation of not so much producing anymore, a little more consuming, affect the type of recovery that we have? I mean, it's true. I mean, we're not producing as much as we used to, and we certainly are buying a lot of stuff. Does that affect the type of recovery we have?
We're going to have a slow recovery in jobs. And one of the reasons is just what you've hit on. We're making a transition from an economy that is almost completely driven by the consumer and consumer borrowing, household borrowing. People are saving more. Growth will be slow. And when you have slow growth, employers are going to work their existing workforce harder and are going to be very reluctant and slow to hire new workers.
Economics correspondent Chris Farrell joining us this morning. We're going to hear you on Marketplace Money this week, right?
That's right. Every week. And it's fun.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks.
We're going get earnings from Amazon later today. It announced that it's buying shoe megasite Zappos.com at an $850 million deal. Amazon and other retail websites, of course, rely on the power of the almighty buck, yet some states have been trying to force those so-called e-tailers to collect sales taxes, and lawmakers are targeting in-state companies that partner with those retailers. From Station KUOW in Seattle, Deborah Wong reports.
HungryGirl.com is a pretty typical example of the kind of company that's now in the spotlight. It's a California-based website that's all about cooking. Its homepage features a colorful, low-calorie cookbook.
So if I were to click on the button that says buy it now, it would take me to the Amazon page, and then I can just complete the purchase right from here.
Patty Smith is a spokeswoman for Amazon. She says Amazon pays Hungry Girl a small commission every time a visitor clicks through and buys a copy of the book, about 4% of the purchase price.
Which, for the referring website, is free money.
HungryGirl.com is what's called an affiliate. Amazon and a host of other retailers have affiliate networks all over the world. They argue affiliates act sort of like advertisers, but some states are challenging that. They say affiliates are like remote sales offices, which means the retailer has a physical presence in the state and would be required to collect state sales tax. State Senator David Hoyle is from North Carolina.
They need to pay us, and it is something that I think is wrong, and we want it fixed.
Last year, New York became the first state to pass a law to that effect, and this year, a host of other states, including North Carolina, Rhode Island, and California, have considered various versions of what's been called the Amazon tax. But it hasn't worked out the way it was intended for states. Jeffrey Lindsay is a senior analyst for the Internet at Sanford Bernstein.
And so in a sense, it kind of backfired.
Amazon and other retailers like Overstock.com have fought back. They've responded by severing their relationships with affiliates in several states, including Rhode Island and North Carolina. So if there are no sales, there's no revenue for the states. That has caused some states to rethink the Amazon tax. The governor of Hawaii recently vetoed a sales tax measure, and the governor of California vowed to veto one as well.
Bearing in mind that particularly California's back down, it'll discourage other states from trying to apply the same rules.
But the fight is by no means over. North Carolina is still debating a version of the tax, and lawmakers in California plan to introduce it again. In Seattle, I'm Deborah Wong for Marketplace.
Hey, check us out online at our website, marketplace.org. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. Have a great day.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.